not nearly enough applause. Thank you. My ego thanks you. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Bill Hatzman, and I have the privilege of introducing tonight's speaker. You may have noticed that I look nothing like Debbie. I don't have her her charm or her wit, so we're going to do this my way. Debbie, by the way, has had some medical challenges. She's been under the care of some physicians. I think she got out of the hospital today. So I will ask you to please keep her in your prayers. We love Debbie, and we want her back here healthy. So, all right. So here at the Valley Group, one of the things that we do is we look high and low for people, members of Alcoholics Anonymous, who are sober, who have had an experience with the 12 steps. We look for those people to come here and tell us about their experience. We ask them to share what their experience has been like as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And tonight I have the privilege of introducing you to a guy that I've gotten to know a little bit over the phone. It was a great privilege to meet him here tonight. He and I got introduced through some H&I work that we're involved with. Our speaker of the week has been sober since April 7th of 1996. He got sober in Santa Monica, and since that time he's been active in H&I, and presently he takes a panel into the Fresno City jails. He's also an intergroup rep for the Fresno Fellowship, so we talk a lot about being of service to the local AA service structure, and that's something that our speaker tonight's involved in. I asked him if he could tell us anything that would, you know, characterize his approach towards recovery, or maybe a slogan that he likes, and we came up with something loosely that sounds like this. Our speaker tonight is not too terribly worried about trying to work a perfect program. Rather, he stays sober by staying active with the steps and in the fellowship and doing his best to play the tape through to the bitter end. So with that, I'd like to introduce our speaker tonight, Ted W. Fresno.
All right.
All yours.
Thank you.
Well, I feel like I'm accepting an Academy Award.
You are.
It is?
Speaker of the week.
Okay. My name is Ted, and I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
This is a great place to have a AA meeting. I mean, I've been, as soon as I walked in here, I could feel the, you know, like the spirit or something good was going on here. And, you know, I guess this is a facility for kids that are challenged, you know. And then I saw the artwork up on here, and some of it's, well, it's all great, you know. And then they have a price tag on it, too, you know. I was kind of wondering about that, but anyway, there's just this whole atmosphere here, and I want to thank all of you for having me here, and thank Bill for inviting me. One of the ladies asked me if I was nervous, you know, before the meeting, and I said, no, I'm not too nervous. And she said, well, if you're not nervous, what are you doing in the ladies' bathroom? So, yeah, I'd really like to welcome the newcomers. There's a lot of newcomers here. And where's Kurt, anyway? I see. Oh, there he is. Hi, Kurt. I'm going to tell you, I don't know how, I've known Kurt for a long time. He's from Fresno. And if this guy can get sober, anybody can. No, he had a rough go of it for quite a while, but he's got it. You know, the doors are always open to us, and we don't have to go away and never come back. You know, my attitude is, you know what, I'm gonna, you know, I've been sober since April 7th, 1996, I haven't had a drink since July 22nd of 1990. So that first 6 years I was on a marijuana maintenance program. And I don't really recommend that for anybody, but back then they didn't have the medicinal thing. Otherwise, I might have reassessed my sobriety day. But, you know, for me, it was about getting honest. It talks about that in Chapter 5. It mentions the word honesty 3 times. And people of real grave emotional mental disorders can have the capacity to get sober if they can get honest. And that was a problem for me. I could not get honest with me, with myself. And I can dupe all of you out there. I can come in here and tell you I've got 40 years or whatever. It doesn't really matter. Or 40 days. Nobody really cares. You know, my sobriety is really God's gift to me. And what I do with that is my gift back to God, you know. And it's important for me to be a service to this program. You know, if you're new, you know, I really want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I did get sober down in Santa Monica. They have these circuit speakers down there, and I remember this circuit speaker lady. I heard her numerous times, and she would say, "Newcomers, welcome to the greatest spiritual movement of the 20th century." And I'd be like, "Wow, I'm part of the greatest spiritual movement of the 20th century. You know, this is a good thing." You know, our program really is in its infancy in the big scheme of things. I mean, it's only been around for 75 years or so. And, you know, we're not supposed to be here. We're not supposed to have productive lives. This is a killer disease. I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to make it all doom and gloom, because I can get that way real easy. There's been two people within the last couple of weeks from my fellowship, their Fresno fellowship, that have killed themselves in the last couple of weeks. So this disease, it will kill you, and it will tell you that you don't have the disease. And I think a lot of us have done that, where we put our hand back over the flame. Talks about that in the big book. See if it's going to burn again. And it burns, and it gets worse, never better. And John Wayne, wherever John Wayne is, he was up here reading that chapter 3, where it's the great obsession of every abnormal drinker to want to drink like a gentleman, and you know, find the loophole, you know, everything that it says there about drinking, you know, beer instead of wine or whatever, and take a trip, don't take a trip, do more exercise, whatever. We're always looking to see if we can kind of skate around it, you know. And for me, you know, my opinion is that I was born an alcoholic. I have it on both sides of my family. And it doesn't make me a bad person. It just makes me an alcoholic. And it's not the worst thing in the world, but I did get dealt the alcoholic card. And so how do I deal with that? I remember just as a kid just kind of being fascinated by alcoholics. I like to be like all of you here tonight. These are my people. You know, I'm very comfortable here with all of you. And if I was in a room of normal people, you know, so-called normies, then I would be. But, you know, this is the only place where we can come in and, you know, we embrace all the misfits and crazy, weird people. Whereas if some of us went into church, for instance, they would slide down the pews to get away from us. You know what I mean? Whereas in here, we, you know, we're all encompassing. And, you know, there's something about this program, like the circuit speaker lady said, that it's just a spiritual program that Bill and Bob got together, and it's one alcoholic working with another, and nobody understands us like we understand ourselves, you know. I mean, when somebody gets up and they're speaking from the heart, I understand that. It doesn't matter what race they are, or male, female. I mean, I understand those feelings. And it was those feelings that I drank over, you know. I'm irritable, restless, discontent. That's what I am by nature, you know. That's an alcoholic. Irritable, restless, discontent. So what do I need to do to take the edge off of that? I need to take a drink. I need to do a line or whatever, you know. And once I start, I can't stop. That's the thing. So I have a disease that's twofold, you know. It's a physical allergy, and I'm not dealing with that today because I haven't done any drugs. I haven't done any alcohol. So the physical allergy is not there today. But it's coupled with a mental obsession. My disease centers in my mind, between my ears. And it's this crazy thing that, and it is a disease. It's like having, cancer, diabetes, whatever, you know, it's a disease. But there's a cure for it. And the cure is what we're doing here tonight. And the steps, and the book, and being involved in this program. And it's a daily reprieve. You know, I can't rest on my laurels. I can't say, okay, I got this thing down. Whenever I hear newcomers, by the way, I really want to welcome newcomers. You know, the newcomers are the lifeblood of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because if it was nothing but old timers and you have to hear the old timers all the time, you know, it would get boring. But when the newcomers come in, they're bird dogging it for me and they're showing me that it's not working out there. So, if you're new, I've got good news and I've got bad news. The good news is you never have to drink again one day at a time. The bad news, look around the room. These are your new friends. Now, newcomers are good. You know, they are the lifeblood of the program. You know, they bring the, you know, you got to get injected with the new stuff. See, my disease that's between my ears and my mind wants to tell me, like the great obsession of every abnormal drinker is, hey, I haven't had a drink for a long time. I think I can go out and drink like a gentleman tonight. Where does that come from? It's the thing that pulls us out of here. And so it's the newcomers that are bird-dogging it, and they're showing me, they don't even have to share, but they're showing me, you know, hey, it's not working out there. Because I still have these thoughts. I mean, these thoughts, they're fleeting thoughts. They just come, and it'll be, you know, the big billboard with the sweaty glass and the beautiful woman in the bikini or something. All of a sudden, I get really thirsty. You know what I mean? I need a drink. And I can taste it. You know, I can feel it. I can feel it, the whole thing. And but I remember just as a kid, we would always have iced tea in the refrigerator. And I would pour the iced tea into a shot glass as a kid, like this tall. And I would throw it back like I was doing a shot of whiskey. You know, the cowboy at the bar, give me another whiskey, you know. And I would kind of pretend that I was drunk. The first time I took a drink, that's exactly how I drank. Wham! Right to the back of my throat. Boom! It was on. I blacked out the first time I drank. That's just how I drank. I never knew anything different than full on. You know, that's just the way I do it. and have done it, and it's the way I do a lot of things, you know. So, you know, alcoholics, there's a certain percentage of people that are alcoholic in the world. It's not a death sentence. You know, the greatest actors, artists, writers, the most creative people on the face of the earth are alcoholic. So if you can channel the energy the right way, you know, you can do tremendous things. They're also the most tortured people on the face of the earth. But all of that, or most of that, is self-induced. We torture ourselves. We are harder on ourselves than we would ever allow anybody to be on us. So that's crazy, but that's what we do. So, you know, perfectionism, guilt, can anybody relate? You know, living in the past, you know, regretting the past, which is one of the promises, by the way, the ninth step promise, is that we won't regret that past. And we can see how that past, you know, has brought us to the point where we are now. So, you know, for me, I was ambitious when I was young, and you know, I bought a home early on, and then my ex-wife got knocked up, and all of a sudden she's living in my home, you know, with a daughter, and then two more kids come along, and man, I wasn't even, 27, 28 years old, and I've got, you know, like three kids, you know. So that happened for me really fast, and felt a lot of pressure with that. And so at that point, the drinking thing wasn't, you know, I mean, I would have alcohol in my, it wasn't like full blown, but when I did drink, it was bad. Anyway, it got to a point where her and I weren't going to get along, and I found out that she was having this affair on me. So it was okay for me to cheat on her, you know, but it wasn't cool for her to be cheating on me. That wasn't cool. And that was just this ego deflator for me. Anyway, I was trying to pass my contractor's test down in L.A. In 1986, I think. And I remember coming all the way from L.A. back to Fresno, like weeping, because I knew that she was going to, you know, be gone when I got there. So I came back to our little house, and the house was completely emptied out. Her and her boyfriend had emptied the house out. She's still married to this guy now. But the thing that really killed me were my kids. My two boys were 2 and 5 at the time, so that was just devastating for me. So what was my solution? I just crawled into a bottle, and that was really my solution, you know. And it was everybody else's fault. She did this to me, and she, you know, it wasn't me. You know, maybe I had a little something to do with it, but it was everybody did me wrong. And from there, I was going into foreclosure on this house, and because I couldn't face the neighbors, and I was embarrassed and all that kind of stuff. And you know, feeling sorry for myself is what I was really, really doing. And then decided that a geographic would be in order, because I was going to lose the house anyway. And Alaska, you know, the great frontier. I had a friend up there in Pelican, Alaska, in, you know, I think they're called the Aleutian Islands or something, you know, those thousand islands that are there. And so I was in this place called Pelican, Alaska. And the only way to get there was by bush plane or boat. And there was no McDonald's. There was no, you know, it was pretty primitive. And I was up there helping these guys build a bunkhouse up there and did a couple commercial fishing things, you know. These were the hardest drinking people I had ever seen. This was like a little controlled environment. The town had about 400 people in it, and then 300 or 400, and then during the fishing season it would swell up to, you know, 1,200-1,500 people, I guess. Anyway, these people were hard drinkers, you know. So anyway, I come up there, I've got my work boots on, you know, and I had a Woolrich jacket all kind of stiff and everything. And I go into the bar there, and everybody has on the Alaskan booties, which are just like the rubber boots, you know. I've got like these shoes that, you know, you slip and slide on the ice and everything. Anyway, this guy is staring at me at the bar, and I'm trying not to do eye contact with this guy. And these were Tlingit Indians up there. So anyway, he had no eye. Where his eye used to be, it was just a hole and no patch. So I think he was kind of trying to show the eye thing off. So I'm staring at this guy at the bar, and he's staring at me, and he's like, hate staring me at the bar. And I found out later that his brother had beat his eye out, you know, in a fight. So this is kind of the people that were up there. And anyway, these were like a town of drunks. And I started to become the town drunk and the town of drunks. And so kind of when I started getting my bearings there and everything, and, you know, they weren't giving me shit anymore. They were starting to become kind of afraid of me. And they actually, you know, there was just all these incidences. I remember working for this foreman guy, and, you know, I kind of have little man disease. This guy was, you know, I mean, he was huge, and he would get in my face because I would be hung over from the night before, and I couldn't get to the job on time. And I would beg my job back. You know, I swear to God, it'll never happen again, man. And I can remember being so sincere that it'll never happen again. I'll never be late again. The next day or 2 days later, you know, that night I'm just having one beer. Boom. This is when I was blacking out big time. Every night was almost a blackout. And that was pretty scary. But I remember the feelings of being so sincere, you know, this is never going to happen again. And me trying to control it, and I was losing complete control of my ability to not drink. And, you know, just crazy incidences there, and people getting thrown off this boardwalk. And, you know, I remember once, I mean, it's like 3 o'clock in the morning or something, and this guy's watching me from the bunkhouse. He told me this the next day. He said, dude, I was watching you from the bunkhouse last night, and you were, you know, hitting one rail and the other, because the boardwalk was all icy. And you were like, boom, boom, boom. And you went face down on the boardwalk. He said, dude, I was so proud of you because you never dropped that beer. And I was like, dude, you're lying. There's no way. I mean, and then I felt my nose, and I was like, oh my God, man, somebody hit the shit out of me last night, because I cannot even remember that, you know. And it was just this blackout, you know, after blackout, not being able to recall anything. And, you know, so they kind of policed the town themselves. They came to me, even my friend that got me the job up there, said, hey, we want you to leave Pelican, Alaska. We don't like you. You're scary, and we want you out of here. So they threw me out of the town. And again, it was like, you know, F you, you know. I mean, it was everybody else's fault. It wasn't my fault. And then I had a round trip ticket back to Fresno by way of L.A., you know, and my girlfriend down there picked me up. And she had to buy me shoes and pants. I was homeless. I didn't have anything. And that was 1990. And so I just kind of shacked up with her. And so she would go to work during the day. And first of all, she went to a Kaiser program for her drinking. And she wanted me to go as her significant other. And I thought, great. If this woman will stop drinking, everything's going to be great, you know. So I went as her significant other, and then to kind of keep an eye on her, too, you know. And I went to this class, and it was run by an alcoholic, and I started identifying for the first time. You know, I never knew anything about AA. And for the first time, it was like, man, I wonder if this is my problem, you know. And then I started going to the West Side Alano Club in West L.A. on Pico Boulevard. You know, it's kind of a room like this. And the noon meetings would have, you know, like 120 people. They were smoking back then, and I smoked. So, you know, I would go in and I would have my cigarettes on one, you know, I would always have to have my back against the wall because I didn't, you know, I didn't like anybody behind me. It's okay now, though. So I'd have my cigarettes on one side, my hot coffee on the other, you know, and this is like a standing room only meeting, you know. I didn't want to, you know, sit next to some dude. And then I certainly didn't want to hold hands with this guy after the meeting. You know, that's all I could think about during the meeting. So I would come in with all this weird negative attitude. But there was something here that was attracting me to the program. And, you know, I remember somebody coming up to me and saying, you know, this is after a couple of months or something of going out there with all this negative, weird attitude. And this guy comes up and says, hey, you seem like you're changing. Like, I see a change in you. And it talks about that in the big book, you know, in the very back in the spiritual experience. That friends of the newcomer will see the change in them before they can see it in themselves. And that was true for me. And by the way, as far as the spiritual experience goes, you don't have to get a white light experience. If you come in here, down in L.A., they used to say, this is called slow variety. We get it a drip at a time, slow variety. And that's the way it is for most of us here. It's been my experience, the people that come in and get the white light experience like Bill Wilson had, they get their wife back in 30 days and their job comes together and all that. You don't see them around here, you know. Most of us, we get this by way of the educational variety it talks about in the spiritual experience. And that's been true for me. This has been slow variety. It's been the educational variety. It's been slow. But it's been good. And so, what was I on that? Anyway, somewhere in there, yeah, the Alano Club. That was a good place for me to be. They could say it's a program of attraction, not promotion, you know. And at that time, it was kind of you remember the movie Urban Cowboy? It kind of died, and then it kind of came back there for a minute. And everybody was out line dancing with the, you know, the cowboy hats and everything. That was kind of the big deal. And there was this meeting, you know. I mean, Santa Monica, there's lots of beautiful people in Santa Monica. This meeting would have like 100 plus people, and the fashion then was all the women were wearing short skirts and cowboy boots, you know, and that was just kind of the fashion in 1990. And so there would be these women and they were all, they all had on short skirts and cowboy boots. There was at least 8 or 10 of them at this meeting. So that was a program of attraction for me. It kept me coming back, you know. And if that gets you here and keeps you here for a minute, that's okay too. You know, whatever gets you here, you know. But that was good. It was good for me to get sober in L.A. because if I'd gotten sober in Fresno, the only people I knew down there were drug addicts and alcoholics. And it's just the way, you know, looking back on all this stuff, the point I wanted to make about coming home to that empty house that time, that was probably the hardest thing ever happened to me. I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy. That was a toughie there. And I wouldn't want to go through that again. But God has a way of taking the worst things that have ever happened to us and turning that somehow into the best thing that ever happened to us. And that's what happened to me. Because it took that for me to get on my spiritual path somehow. Not easy, and I didn't just jump on the spiritual path. I mean, you know, I had to go get beat up in Pelican, Alaska, and then I came and found this program, and, you know, getting sober down there was a pretty cool thing because, you know, you'd be in the room, there'd just be, you know, these beautiful movie stars and rock stars, and then there'd be the homeless guy pushing the shopping cart. You know, if you want to be homeless, that's a good place to be homeless down there because you can sleep in the park and they'll feed you, you know. So in my mind, I would, you know, I thought that I was going to be homeless. You know, I saw myself pushing a shopping cart when I was first sober, and I've never had to do that other than from the grocery store to my car. You know, this is my head projecting again, you know, where our heads will take us, you know, to places that are not a cool place to go. And I've always had a lot of good breaks since I've been sober. A lot of good breaks have happened to me. A lot of 11th hour reprieves, more than I can count. Somehow God has a way of just intervening, you know, when you're sober and you're kind of attuned to it, it's all good. And I have tried hard to fill myself up with outside things to make me feel better on the inside. And I remember my sponsor telling me this when I was a newcomer. He said, dude, this is not an outside program. This is an inside program. Because I refused to be happy until I had the right amount of money, the right job, the right girlfriend, the right place to live, the right car. Then I'm going to be happy on the inside. You know, I've, in sobriety, have chased all that outside stuff. And I'm here to tell you that it doesn't fill this God-shaped hole that's inside of me. The only thing that fills up my... is my relationship with God, my higher power. It's the only thing that works. And I think that this program has been, you know, divinely inspired for people like us that don't fit anyplace else. And that was the thing. That was the big thing when I went to that West Side Alano Club. First, I started to kind of identify, you know, man, is this what's been going on with me? And then I came to it. And it was like, yeah, I've always been the square peg trying to get into the round hole. I've never fit in. And suddenly I fit in, you know. These are my people. These are my people. And then it was like, oh my God, this is what's been wrong with me all my life. I'm an alcoholic and I didn't even know it, you know. All the resentment and the this and that, and, you know, just the, I always felt like I was better than everybody or not good enough. You know, I never just felt like I was just part of the deal until I got here. now I feel like I'm part of the deal, you know? And, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous really is the best thing that's ever happened to me, you know? And because it's been my path, my spiritual path, to connect up with my higher power, you know? And I believe in God. I was raised up in the church and all that. But, you know, what I really love about this program is it's a God of your own understanding. You know, it's not, you know, you believe my God, my way, or you're ousted and you're going to hell or whatever, you know. And at that Westside Alano Club, Lisa B. read that second tradition. You have the traditions hanging around here? The second tradition says, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority. And she said, a loving God, as he may express himself. And she emphasized, a loving God. And I was like, oh my God, I've heard this thousands of times, and then I finally heard it. This is about a loving God here. This is not this church God that I came in here with. You know, this is a God that wants what's best for me, more than I could ever want for myself. I don't have to walk on water. That's Jesus' job. That's not my job. I don't have to be perfect. That's what I've learned here is, you know, it's in getting up and taking another step. It's not falling down, but, you know, getting up and moving forward, you know, and getting honest with my people and my sponsor and letting people into my life. And I don't have to do this thing perfectly. Like, you know, what Bill was saying there, I don't work a perfect program. I don't think anybody does. And it's not, I don't have to be perfect, you know. It says it in the chapter 5 that we read at every meeting. Progress, not perfection. I don't have to be perfect. I claim progress, not perfection. You know, the only thing that I've ever really done right over all these years is I've really have not gone to meetings. You know, I've always felt at home coming to these meetings. I've never gone a year or 6 months or, you know, I still do at least, you know, 3 to 5 meetings a week. You know, that's just my thing. This is like kind of going to church for me. You know, this is where I connect up with people. This is where I have social we're social creatures. I need to be around all of you, and I'd rather be around you than a lot of people out there. And this is just a great place for me. So, you know, if you're new, if I decide that I'm going to punish all of you by never coming back here again, and you'll never see me again, I'm going to cop a resentment on you. You will never see me in this meeting, or you're going to be so sorry that I'll never come back again. Guess what? AA is going to carry on just fine without me. Is going to do real well without Ted being here. I need this program. I need all of you. You don't need me. I need you. And we do it together. So, you know, I just, it's really a privilege for me to be able to come in to this meeting, you know, tonight and be with all of you tonight. And then tomorrow I need to go do it again. You know, I just get a daily reprieve on this thing. It takes a lot for me to stay sober. And so, you know, there's a good chance tonight that I'm not going to drink, and then tomorrow's a new day. But, you know, I really want to bless all of you. I want, you know, God bless all of you, man. You know, if you're here, you're in the right place. If your life is falling apart right now, and you don't think it's ever going to get any better, and it's as bad as it's ever been, that's a good place to be, man. Just stay close, hang in here, because that could be the best thing that's ever happened, you know, getting to that point. When I go into jail meetings, I like to go to the jail meetings, because when I'm sitting across from these guys in the red jumpsuit, you know, I'm just one drink away from being in there with these guys, you know. I go to meetings where, you know, I mean, this kid in Fresno, these two people were in NA, you know, they were at McKinley and Blackstone, and on their motorcycle, a man and his wife, just sitting at the stoplight, and this kid in a blackout, wham, hit him, doing 110 miles an hour. Maybe you remember that. It was about, I think it's been about a year ago or so now. And so I got to know this kid in H&I before they sent him off to Wasco. Really good looking Hispanic kid. Man, his life changed big time. I felt sorry for him, you know. And then this guy that knew these people, he said, you know what? I got no sympathy for that guy. Because I went in and I saw my friend and his head was as big as a watermelon before they pulled the plug on him. So this is a disease that not only will kill you, but it kills other people too. You know, it's a killer disease. And what a drag that is for with that kid. I know he feels sorry for himself, but he's caused, you know, all this ripple effect of how many people that he's affected by having a really bad night of drinking. So anyway, I hate to kind of end on a real downer like that, but I want to just say thank you and God bless all of you, and thank you for letting me speak with you tonight.